Have you ever looked at the news, or maybe your workplace, or just the broader economy, and felt this, I don't know, this profound, almost paralyzing sense of disconnection?
Oh, absolutely. I think everyone feels that right now.
Right. Like, think about your day-to-day life for a second. You probably interact with dozens of systems that are just incredibly efficient at measuring data.
Yeah, hyper efficient.
Exactly. I mean, your company tracks your output, your wearable device is, monitoring your heart rate,
Yeah.
and algorithms track every single millisecond you linger on a video.
They know exactly what you're doing.
Yeah. We've built a world that is completely obsessed with high-definition measurement. But somehow, simultaneously, it feels like these very same systems are, well, completely blind to what actually makes life worth living.
It creates a very specific, almost modern flavor of exhaustion, doesn't it?
Exhaustion is the perfect word for it.
Because we are drowning in metrics, and yet, as living, breathing human beings, we feel entirely unseen by the structures that govern our lives. I mean, the data is perfect, but the actual lived reality is deteriorating.
I was actually trying to describe this feeling the other day, and the best way I could articulate it is it's like having access to a billion-dollar state-of-the-art X-ray machine.
Okay, I like this.
Right, so it takes these perfectly crisp, high-resolution pictures of your bones. It can measure the density of your calcium down to the micrometer,
The ultimate measurement.
but the machine is completely incapable of showing whether or not you are actually in pain.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
The pain, which is obviously the most important part of your experience, just doesn't register on the scan at all.
It's invisible to the system.
Exactly. And today we are taking a deep dive into an incredible piece of source material that addresses exactly this invisible pain. We are exploring a text by Dr. Bechara Saheeli called Bringing Forth the More Beautiful World.
Which is such a massive, ambitious work.
It really is. And I want to set expectations right up front for you listening. This isn't just, another cynical critique of modern society complaining about how broken capitalism is.
We have enough of those.
Right. Way too many. This is an entirely new grammar. The author is trying to build a framework for what he calls a life-coherent civilization.
Completely different way of organizing reality.
Yes, so the mission of our deep dive today is to give you, the listener, a new vocabulary to decode why the world feels so hollow, and more importantly, how to actually talk about fixing it.
And a new vocabulary is not just an academic luxury right now. It is an urgent necessity.
How so?
Well, because if you look at how we try to solve crises of human suffering today, whether it's an epidemic of loneliness or ecological collapse or economic inequality, we are using the exact same mechanical transactional language that created the crises in the first place.
We're using the X-ray machine to treat the pain.
Exactly. You cannot optimize your way out of a crisis of meaning using a spreadsheet. It just doesn't work.
Okay, let's unpack this. Our journey today is going to move from the very cold technical architecture of systems theory right into the warm beating heart of what the text calls the call.
That's a beautiful transition.
From there, we are going to look for a way to test what is objectively good for life. And finally, we'll explore how the very words we speak can be used as tools to heal the world.
What's fascinating here is how seamlessly this text bridges incredibly hard science. And we are talking about theoretical biology, cybernetics, information theory, with the deeply human, almost poetic experiences of grief, vulnerability, and care.
It's quite a mix.
It really is. It takes the sterile equations of how biological systems survive and breathes humanity into them.
So to fix a broken machine, you first have to understand the power source, right? You have to understand what makes it go.
Yes, the fundamental driver.
The text starts by looking at what makes a living thing move, and it brings up a concept from a biological anthropologist named Terence Deacon. Deacon uses a term called absence.
Absence, yeah.
And I have to be honest, when I first read that, it sounded incredibly bleak.
Well, on the surface, it definitely sounds like a philosophical void.
Right.
But in technical terms, Deacon argues that living systems are uniquely organized around what is not yet present.
What is not present?
Right. To grasp this, contrast a living thing with a non-living thing. If you put a rock on a table, the rock just sits there.
It's just a rock.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is entirely defined by what is physically present, its minerals, its mass, its shape. But if you think about a single biological cell, its entire structure, its membrane, its behavior, they are all organized around the nutrients it does not currently have,
Oh, I see.
or the threat that has not yet destroyed it. A living system, at its most fundamental biological level, is defined by its dynamic relationship to the missing things it needs to survive.
I'm trying to wrap my head around this because absence feels like literally nothing.
It does.
How can a system organize around nothing? I mean, if I'm starving, I don't sit on my couch and think, ah, I am currently experiencing an abstract deficit of caloric intake.
You definitely do not.
Right. My stomach hurts. I feel a dry. It's a very active, aggressive feeling, not a passive void.
And that is the crucial distinction. In the realm of physics, absence might just be empty space. But in biology, absence creates tension.
Tension.
And this is where Dr. Sayali makes a brilliant translation in the text. He takes this cold scientific concept of absence and translates it into a much warmer term, the call.
The call.
Right. He moves us from mechanical description into phenomenology.
Let's pause there for a second. Phenomenology. That's a heavy academic word. Let's make sure we are all on the same page.
Fair point. Yeah. Phenomenology is simply the philosophical study of lived experience.
Okay.
It's not about how things are measured objectively by a machine. It's about how things actually feel to the subject experiencing them.
So from the inside looking out.
Exactly. So in lived experience, what is missing doesn't feel like empty space. It feels like a demand.
A demand.
Think about an infant. A crying child is not an abstract deficit of parental proximity.
No, it's a very loud demand.
To the parent, that cry is a visceral, unmistakable call. Or think about nature. A dry, cracked riverbed isn't just a negative hydrological variable on an environmental report.
It's a cry for water.
Yes, it is a call for ecological repair.
I look at it a bit like architecture.
Yeah.
Think about building a house.
Okay, let's hear it.
If you want to truly understand a house, you can't just tally up the materials. You can't just list the wood, the nails, the drywall, the copper wiring.
Right, that's just a pile of stuff.
Exactly.
Right.
If you only look at what is physically present, you miss the entire point of the structure. A house is actually organized around invisible spaces.
That's a great way to put it.
It's organized around, you know, the human need for shelter from the storm, the call for a quiet place to rest, the desire for intimacy and family gathering.
A negative space?
Yes. The physical materials, the walls and the roof, they only exist to answer those invisible calls.
The materials are just the constraints and the provisions. The actual meaning of the house is the call that it answers.
Right.
Now let's scale that analogy up and apply it to modern civilization.
Let's do it.
If you want to know why society feels so deeply pathological and disconnected right now, it is because our dominant systems, our global economy, our corporate bureaucracies, our political polling, they only measure the nails and the wood.
The things that are physically there.
Yes. They only measure what is physically present and quantifiable. They track quarterly profits, factory outputs, clicks, engagement metrics, gross domestic product.
The spreadsheet stuff?
Exactly. But in doing so, they completely ignore the invisible organizers of life. They ignore hunger because hunger doesn't have a profit margin.
Wow.
They ignore loneliness because you can't tax it. They ignore the silent calls of future generations or the calls of the local watershed because those entities aren't actively participating in the market.
It's like we've built a planetary sound system with massive speakers and incredibly sensitive microphones, but the microphones are completely muted to any frequency that doesn't involve a financial transaction.
That is exactly what we've done. And the text makes a very bold claim here. It says a civilization collapses first in its perception.
Before anything physically breaks.
Before the bridges fall, before the food supply chain breaks, the civilization goes blind and deaf.
That is terrifying.
It is. If a society organizes its entire structure to answer the calls of the stock market while systematically ignoring the calls of its children or the calls of its topsoil, it becomes pathological.
Even if it looks successful.
Right. It might look incredibly efficient on a spreadsheet. The GDP might be soaring, but it is effectively hostile to life.
If you are listening to this right now, think about your own town or city. What would our world look like if the fundamental perception shifted?
It would be revolutionary.
Imagine walking into a city council meeting, and instead of the budget being framed as a list of expenditures and tax revenues, it was literally mapped out as a geography of answered and unanswered calls.
It would completely upend public policy. Let's take healthcare as an example.
That's a big one.
Currently, a hospital administrator looks at a dashboard of billed procedures, bed turnover rates, and insurance reimbursements.
Very mechanical.
The system is answering the call for financial solvency. But what if we measured the success of a healthcare system, not by the volume of interventions, but by the volume of restored capacities to live fully?
That changes everything.
What if the metric wasn't, did we dispense the medication efficiently, but rather did we answer the patient's call to return to a meaningful life?
I love the vision of that. Truly, I do.
Yeah.
But I need to push back here because this sounds a little utopian.
Sure, let's push back.
If we say that everything that is missing is a call, things are going to get messy really fast.
How so?
Well, for example, as I'm sitting here, I have a desire for a brand new, ridiculously expensive electric guitar.
Okay.
I can't even play the guitar that well, but I really want it. Or think about like a tech billionaire who has a burning desire for a third mega yacht.
Right.
Are those calls? How do we separate a true, genuine call of life from a clever marketing trick or a fleeting impulse or just pure ego?
You're hitting on the core problem, and the author actually anticipates this. We have to dissect the anatomy of a call.
Break it down.
The text is extremely deliberate about this. A call is not synonymous with a desire.
Okay, that's an important distinction.
Massive distinction. Modern consumer culture spends billions of dollars every year specifically to train your nervous system to experience every single passing impulse as a profound existential call that must be answered immediately with a purchase.
Right. Every commercial tells you a story of deficit. You are missing this car, therefore you lack freedom.
Exactly.
You're missing this anti-aging cream, therefore you are losing your youth and love.
They manufacture the absence.
They completely manufacture it. Because we are constantly bombarded by manufactured absences, the author provides a specific lexicon to help us filter the noise.
So how do we filter it?
He breaks down a true call into six distinct components.
Six components. Okay, lay them on me.
First, there is the need. This isn't a want. This is the actual life condition at stake.
Like actual hunger or a need for shelter.
Exactly. Second is towardness.
Towardness. Yeah. Which is life's natural biological or psychological orientation toward fulfilling that need. It's the drive.
Okay, got it.
Third is mattering, which is the value field. It explains why this specific thing is significant to a living being's survival or flourishing.
Why it actually counts.
Right. Fourth is provision, which is the concrete answering of the need, the actual food, the actual shelter.
Makes sense.
Fifth is repair, which is the necessary restoration of broken relations when a call has been previously ignored.
Healing the damage.
Yes. And finally, the sixth component is becoming.
Becoming.
Which is the expansion of life capacity over time once the call is answered.
It is a lot to digest. let's run an example through that six-part filter.
Okay, let's use your guitar.
Let's take my desire for that electric guitar. The desire is for a piece of wood and electronics.
Right.
But if I'm being really honest with myself, the actual need hiding underneath that desire isn't musical instrumentation.
What is it?
I work long hours, I'm stressed, and I feel disconnected from my creative side. So the true call is a need for play, or maybe a need for expression.
Let's test that. If the true need is for creative expression, the towardness is your mind reaching out for an outlet.
Okay.
The mattering is that without play, your psychological health degrades.
Which is very true.
Now, what is the provision? Consumer capitalism tells you the provision is spending $3,000 on the guitar.
That's what the targeted ads tell me.
But here is the dangerous part. What happens when you buy it and it just sits in the corner of your room because you are still working 60 hours a week?
I feel guilty looking at it.
Right.
My capacity hasn't expanded. I haven't reached that final stage of becoming.
Which means the guitar was a false answer.
False answer.
This is a massive concept in the text. A false answer is when a system appears to address a call, but it actually leaves the underlying need completely unmet.
Or it just masks it.
Or worse, it deepens the wound while temporarily numbing the pain.
I see where you're going. The system hears the call, but it intentionally mistranslates it to serve its own purpose.
Yes. Think about the broadest societal trends. Consumerism falsely answers the call for meaning by giving you endless material acquisition.
Which never actually satisfies.
Never! Nationalism falsely answers the call for belonging and community by giving you an outgroup to hate.
Oh, that's a dark one, but yeah, it's so true.
And social media falsely answers the profound human call to be seen and recognized by giving you cheap metrics of attention, you know, likes, retweets, view counts.
It's just numbers on a screen.
In all these cases, the system simulates the feeling of an answered call. You get a little spike of dopamine.
A little rush.
But the actual life capacity of the person is not expanded. Over time, it is systematically drained.
I want to offer an analogy here because it reminds me of an autoimmune disorder.
Oh, I like that. Let's explore that.
In a healthy body, the immune system answers the call of infection by attacking the virus and saving the host.
Doing its job.
Right. But in an autoimmune disorder, the defense system gets confused It loses its ability to recognize what is healthy tissue and what is a threat.
Right.
It starts attacking the very organs it is supposed to protect.
Mm.
Commodified calls, these false answers, operate the exact same way.
Yes, they do.
We have a profound need for connection, so we build global communication platforms. But those platforms are designed to maximize outrage and division to sell ads.
So the provision attacks the host.
The provision ends up attacking the very social fabric it was supposed to weave together.
I take it a step further. It's like being stranded in the ocean and drinking salt water when you're dying of thirst.
Oh, wow.
For one brief, agonizing second, as the water hits your tongue, your brain signals relief. It thinks, ah, liquid, I am provisioned.
Right, it feels like an answer.
But biologically, the salt content is drawing water out of your cells. It is actively killing you faster. It accelerates the dehydration under the guise of hydration.
That is a terrifyingly accurate way to frame what happens when we scroll through an outrage feed trying to feel connected to the world.
It's digital salt water.
But what happens if we just tune it out? What happens if calls go completely unheard?
Well, the text is very clear that an ignored call doesn't just vanish into the ether. It returns as pathology.
Returns as pathology. Let's ground this. What does that pathology look like in real life?
Let's go back to a medical setting because it is the most visceral example.
Okay.
Imagine a patient who comes into a clinic experiencing severe chronic insomnia and panic attacks.
It sounds awful.
It is. That presentation is a call. But suppose the doctor is overworked, restricted by insurance protocols to a 10-minute visit, and only hears a biological symptom.
Right. The doctor just sees a broken sleep cycle.
Exactly. So the doctor answers solely by writing a prescription for a heavy sedative.
Which technically addresses the symptom. I mean, the patient might sleep.
They might sleep, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But the doctor completely ignored the patient's deeper calls.
What were those deeper calls?
Maybe the patient is a single parent working 3 gig economy jobs, terrified of eviction, and dealing with an abusive ex-partner.
Oh, wow.
The calls for physical safety, for relational repair, for economic stability, they are completely unheard.
So the pill is?
The pill is a provision, but it's a false answer to the structural crisis. It merely chemically masks the distress of a person whose life ground is collapsing.
So the alarm bell is turned off, but the house is still on fire.
And eventually, the fire consumes the structure. On a macroscopic societal level, an unheard call for justice doesn't just disappear.
Where does it go?
It goes underground and returns as political polarization, riots, or violence. A child's unheard call for secure attachment doesn't evaporate either.
It transforms.
It transforms into adult aggression or severe withdrawal. Violence in this framework is often just the tragic, mutated form of an unanswered call.
If you are listening, you might be feeling a bit overwhelmed right now because we are swimming in this reality.
We really are.
We are drowning in notifications, advertisements, political outrage, real global emergencies, fake manufactured emergencies.
It's relentless.
How on earth are we supposed to filter through all these competing signals? Mm-hmm. How do we tune our ears to hear the true calls of life when the false answers are literally screaming at us?
To navigate that chaos, the text turns to the work of the anthropologist and systems theorist Gregory Bateson.
Okay, Bateson.
Bateson is famous for his foundational definition of information. He defined information simply as a difference that makes a difference.
A difference that makes a difference.
Yeah.
I've actually heard that phrase tossed around in tech circles, but let's really break it down. What does that actually mean?
Let's use a physical example. Imagine a leaf falling off a tree in the middle of a dense forest.
Okay.
Does that event create a difference in the physical universe?
I mean, technically, yes. Yes, a tiny shift in air pressure, a microscopic change in the soil composition.
Mm-hmm.
But if it doesn't impact any living system's behavior or understanding, if it doesn't cross a threshold of relevance, it's not truly information in a meaningful sense.
It's just background noise.
Exactly. It's noise.
Okay. But how does Dr. Sanley adapt Bateson's concept for this new life-coherent grammar? Because right now, every notification on my phone claims to be a difference that makes a difference.
They all scream for attention.
Yeah, like breaking news, celebrity does something embarrassing.
And that is where the author introduces a critical filter. In a civilization completely overwhelmed by data, a life-coherent difference is one that actually helps living beings perceive what matters, answer what is calling, and open viable futures.
Which strongly implies there are differences that do the exact opposite.
Oh, absolutely.
Theorist is designed to hijack our attention without offering any life-coherent value.
The text calls this counterfeit relevance.
Counterfeit relevance. That is such a strong phrase. If you want to understand modern media and politics, you have to understand this concept. Modern civilization operates as a massive engine designed to amplify noise and suppress signal.
That feels incredibly true.
It amplifies whatever is most profitable, whatever is sensational, whatever triggers the amygdala.
The fear response.
Right. That is the noise. Meanwhile, it actively suppresses what is slow, what is relational, or what is ecological, because those things don't generate immediate capital.
They don't make money.
Right. That is the signal.
Counterfeit relevance. Let's dig into the mechanics of that. This isn't just about being distracted, is it? This is about psychological manipulation.
It is entirely by design.
Social media algorithms are the ultimate engines of counterfeit relevance. Think about how they are coded. They are literally designed by engineers to find the exact difference that makes you angry, the difference that makes you jealous, the difference that makes you click.
And let's look at the psychology behind why it works so well. Counterfeit relevance excites your nervous system.
It gets you fired up.
It floods you with adrenaline and cortisol. It simulates the feeling of mattering.
Simulates it.
When you are engaged in a furious debate on a social platform about a controversial news headline, your body feels like it is engaged in tribal warfare.
It feels like life or death.
It feels deeply important, but it completely bypasses any actual responsibility or life provisioning.
You aren't actually doing anything.
You aren't feeding anyone. You aren't repairing a relationship. You are just burning energy in a void.
I can personally attest to this. I remember a few months ago, I got sucked into a complete meaningless argument online with a stranger about municipal zoning laws of a city I don't even live in.
Oh, no. We've all been there.
I was furious. My heart rate was up. I spent an hour researching data to prove this stranger wrong.
An hour you'll never get back.
Exactly. I found the ultimate stat, posted it, and felt this massive rush of victory. But when I finally looked up from my screen, my own house was a mess, I hadn't eaten dinner, and I was exhausted.
You were depleted.
Completely. I was so consumed by counterfeit relevance that I ignored the actual calls of my own life. While we are all arguing over highly optimized, algorithmically generated outrage, we are completely blind to the slow, quiet signals of ecological collapse happening right outside our windows.
Your story illustrates perfectly that signal and noise are entirely relational.
Relational? How so?
The text uses a beautiful distinction here. Let's go back to that falling leaf.
Okay.
To a commuter rushing to the office in their car, a leaf falling on the windshield is meaningless noise.
It's just a distraction.
It's a mild annoyance to be wiped away by the wipers. But to a farmer standing in an orchard, that exact same falling leaf is a vital signal.
Oh, because it tells them about the trees.
Right. It carries profound information about the changing season, the hydration levels of the tree, and the health of the soil.
The physical event is exactly the same.
The physical event is identical. The meaning depends entirely on the relation.
So we have to cultivate the relation of the farmer rather than the commuter.
Exactly. We have to tune our relationship.
And that brings up this really profound idea from the text differences can either open life or close life.
Let's test that concept because it's vital. A difference that closes life might be a rigid, prejudiced social category.
Like what?
Let's say a society categorizes people based on race or caste. Does that categorization make a difference?
Sadly, yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It profoundly alters how someone is treated, where they can live, what jobs they can hold. But it is a difference that narrows, restricts, and damages life capacity.
It tracks people.
By contrast, an accurate medical diagnosis, say, discovering a patient has a specific vitamin deficiency, also makes a difference. But it opens life.
Because it leads to a cure?
Right. It provides a clear path to healing, to understanding, to provision, and repair.
I want the listener to really hold on to that distinction between opening and closing life, because it applies to how we talk to our families, our coworkers, everyone.
It changes how you communicate.
It is the fundamental difference between making a point and making a difference.
Oh, that's good.
Think about the last time you had a political argument with a family member over a holiday dinner.
A classic scenario.
Right. You can be armed with facts. You can expose a flaw in their logic. You can thoroughly humiliate your opponent and win the debate.
You crush them.
You definitely made a point. You created a difference. But if you destroy the relationship in the process, if you made them feel small and defensive, you blocked any path to mutual repair.
You closed the door.
You engaged in a life incoherent difference. You won the battle of facts, but you closed life.
And this reality forces us to confront a massive philosophical problem.
What's the problem?
Well, If we have to filter for differences that matter, and if we have to answer true calls instead of falling for counterfeit relevance, what is our compass?
How do we know what actually matters?
Exactly. What is the objective ground for mattering? If we are rejecting GDP, engagement metrics, and corporate profit as the ultimate measuring sticks of a civilization, what is the hard metric we use instead?
We can't just rely on good vibes.
No, we absolutely cannot rely on vibes.
We need a rigorous measuring stick. And Dr. Saheeli provides one by drawing on the work of the Canadian philosopher John McMurtry.
McMurtry's work is essential here.
McMurtry developed a framework called the life value ontaxiology.
Let's pause and unpack that term before we lose anyone, because it is dense.
Please do. Ontaxiology sounds like a medical procedure.
It does. Let's break it into its Greek roots. Onto refers to ontology, which is the study of being or what is fundamentally real.
Okay, what is real?
Axiology is the study of value or what is good. So an ontaxiology is a framework that links what is real with what is valuable.
Reality and value connected.
McMurtry proposes a primary axiom for this framework. He states that good is whatever enables a more coherently inclusive range of thought, felt being, and action.
Thought, felt being, and action.
Yes. Conversely, bad is whatever reduces, disables, or destroys that range of thought, felt being, and action.
Let me sit with that for a second. Good opens capacity. Bad closes capacity.
That's the distillation of it.
It is incredibly simple.
Yeah.
But if you actually apply it, it's radical. It applies to literally everything from environmental policy to how you treat your neighbor.
It is entirely universal. And from this primary axiom, McMurtry derives the concept of universal human life necessity.
Necessities. Not wants.
Right. These are not abstract policy preferences. They aren't things you debate in a parliament or negotiate in a trade deal. They are the objective, non-negotiable conditions required for human capacity to exist at all.
Like what?
We are talking about breathable air, clean water, nourishing food, safe shelter.
The basics of survival.
But importantly, it also includes psychological necessities. The need for touch, the need for play, the need for meaningful work.
Wow, play is a necessity.
Under this framework, yes. If you deprive any human being of these things, regardless of their culture or era, their capacity to think, feel, and act is objectively reduced or destroyed.
They aren't luxuries. If you don't have water, your organs shut down and you die. But also, if a child is deprived of play, their cognitive and social development is measurably stunted.
Their capacity is closed.
This framework gives us a way to make a vital economic distinction between life capital and false capital.
Let's explore that distinction because it changes how we view wealth.
Okay, break it down.
Life capital includes things that naturally produce more life capacity over time.
So, a forest.
A healthy, biodiverse forest is life capital, yes. A robust public health system is life capital. Deep social trust within a community or a well-funded education system, these are forms of wealth that generate more life.
And what is false capital?
False capital, on the other hand, is a specific mutation of wealth. It is money that multiplies itself while actively degrading the life ground.
Going back to the autoimmune analogy.
Yes, exactly.
False capital is when the economy starts eating the society it relies on.
Eating itself.
Imagine a massive hedge fund swooping into a small municipality and buying up the local water treatment system.
A very real scenario.
Right. Their fiduciary duty is to maximize payouts to their shareholders. So they fired the maintenance staff, they neglect the infrastructure, and they raise the prices.
Classic extraction.
Eventually, the pipes degrade and the town gets sick. The capital multiplied. The shareholders get richer. So traditional economics looks at that spreadsheet and says, success. Growth occurred.
The line went up.
But under McMurtry's metric, it is an objective failure. The life capital was destroyed.
That is the exact pathology this text is diagnosing. The measurement system is completely inverted. And to cure it, the author argues we have to embrace a concept that is deeply terrifying to modern economics.
Which is?
The necessity of enoughness rather than endless growth.
Enoughness. Okay. Just saying the word feels like taking a deep breath.
Doesn't it? It is the necessary middle path. Let's look at the extremes. On one end, scarcity produces fear, trauma, and biological degradation.
We don't want scarcity.
No. But excess, which is the holy grail of modern growth models, produces domination, waste, and extraction.
It's never satisfied.
Enoughness asks a radically different question of our systems. It asks, do we have sufficient provision to answer the calls of life?
Once we do, we stop.
Exactly. Once the answer is yes, Once the universal life necessities are met, further extraction is not only unnecessary, it becomes actively harmful.
I think we need to talk about where this understanding of enoughness actually comes from.
Okay, where does it start?
Because human beings aren't born with an innate understanding of macroeconomics. The text argues this provisioning starts from the very first moments of life.
Right, in infancy.
It brings in the work of developmental psychologist Dircea Narváez, specifically her concept of the evolved nest.
Narváez's work is critical here. The evolved nest is treated in this text not just as a recommended parenting style, but as the very first civil commons.
The first civil commons. That's powerful.
For hundreds of thousands of years of human evolution, infants were raised in a specific environment. This nest includes nearly constant soothing touch, rapid responsiveness to cries, free play with multiple ages, and a village of multiple caregivers.
Not just a nuclear family in a suburban house.
No, a whole nested community. And these are not just nice, optional things to do for a baby. They are civilizational infrastructures.
Let's talk about the how and why of that, because this blew my mind when I read it.
It's incredible science.
When a baby is born, their brain is incredibly malleable. It is waiting for signals from the environment to know what kind of world it has been born into.
Right, it's gathering data.
If a baby cries, which is a call, and a caregiver immediately responds with warmth and touch, the baby's nervous system receives a chemical provision.
Oxytocin.
Oxytocin is released. The brain literally wires itself for trust. It learns that calls are answered.
But consider the alternative. The text argues that an under-nested child, a child who is left to cry it out, who is deprived of responsive care, who lacks touch and play, experiences a chemical flood of cortisol.
Stress hormones.
Massive stress. Their developing brain interprets the environment as hostile and scarce. The child often grows up to be a dysregulated adult. Their nervous system is permanently wired for threat detection.
And this has massive political implications.
Massive.
A population of dysregulated, under-nested adults is incredibly vulnerable to fear languaging.
Because they are already afraid.
Yes. They are susceptible to authoritarian politics because they are desperate for an external figure to provide the safety they never internalized.
The strongman figure.
And they are vulnerable to addictive consumption because they're constantly trying to fill an unprovisioned void. We literally build the emotional and political stability of our civilization in the crib.
Which radically redefines what we consider a good in our society.
How so?
In classical economics, if a commodity sells, the market designates it as a good.
People want it, so it's good.
Right. But under McMurtry's framework, weapons, addictive social media algorithms, or ultra-processed foods are false goods.
Because they close life.
They generate massive profit, yes, but they actively close life capacity. They reduce the range of thought, feeling, and action of the population consuming them.
This whole discussion completely shatters our modern idea of freedom.
It really does.
If you ask the average person on the street what freedom is, they will usually define it as consumer choice.
Right, having options.
I have 50 different types of cereal to choose from in the supermarket, therefore I am free. Or they define it as non-interference.
Don't tread on me.
Exactly. The government isn't telling me what to do, therefore I am free.
Uh-huh.
But under this life value metric, a starving person isn't free, even if nobody is actively interfering with them.
Because they have no capacity.
True freedom actually requires the provision of life necessities.
Mm-hmm.
You aren't free to think, feel, and act if you are exhausted, sick, and terrified of losing your housing.
It's a profound realization. Freedom is not a void of regulation. Freedom requires a robust, life-supporting commons.
If we redefine freedom that drastically, we have to reframe our ideas of violence and peace as well.
We do.
Because normally when I hear the word violence, I picture a bar fight or a robbery or a war. I picture physical assault.
To expand that definition, the author integrates the work of the renowned peace researcher Johann Galtung.
Okay, Galtung.
In this life-coherent grammar, violence is defined fundamentally as unanswered life.
Unanswered life. Let that sink in.
It changes everything. Galtung makes a distinction between direct violence and structural violence.
What's the difference?
Direct violence, like an assault or a bombing, is the immediate physical silencing of a life's call. It is overt and visible.
You can see it happen.
But structural violence is far more insidious. Structural violence is when non-answers are built directly into the design of our social and economic systems.
Built into the rules.
When a society possesses more than enough resources to house and feed everyone, but structurally denies food, housing, or health care to a segment of its population based on their ability to pay, That is an act of violence.
Even if nobody throws a punch.
Even if no one throws a punch, it is an active, systemic reduction of life capacity.
So poverty isn't just a glitch in the system or a personal failure. In a society of abundance, poverty is the system operating violently by design.
Precisely why Galtung's concept of peace is so demanding.
Demand?
Yes. Peace isn't simply the absence of war. Galtung calls the mere absence of conflict negative peace.
Negative peace.
If a dictator rules with an iron fist and nobody's fighting back because they are terrified, there is no war, but there is certainly no peace.
It's just silent domination.
What we must strive for is positive peace, and positive peace is the presence of answered life.
The presence of answered life.
It is the active social, economic, and ecological organization of conditions where life's calls can actually be heard, respected, and provisioned.
That is an incredibly high bar. Positive peace requires constant active coordination.
It's an ongoing process.
And that leads to the final, perhaps most practical question of this whole deep dive. We have this ultimate metric for life-opening capacity.
Right.
We know we need to provision universal life necessities. But human beings aren't a hive mind. We aren't ants.
No, we are very messy individuals.
How do we actually coordinate this? How do I share my calls with you, and how do we organize the provisions?
We coordinate it through language. But, and this is a massive caveat, the text is very careful to explain that we must discard how we typically understand language in the modern world.
I think most of us view language as basically transferring data.
Like a machine.
Right. I have a thought in my brain. I encode it in English words. I vibrate my vocal cords. The sound waves hit your ears and you decode the data. It's like sending an email.
That is the mechanical cybernetic view of language. But the text introduces the work of the Chilean biologist Humberto Maturana and his concept of languaging.
Languaging. Notice it's a verb.
Right. An action.
Yeah.
Maturana argued that we don't just use words to point at a pre-existing objective reality. Through the act of languaging, we actually bring forth shared worlds.
We create the world.
We coordinate our actions.
Yeah.
And in doing so, we literally construct the social reality we inhabit. Language isn't just descriptive, it is generative.
And the author layers on top of Maturana this incredibly radical idea from the feminist linguist Genevieve Vaughan.
Vaughan's work is revolutionary here.
Vaughan argues that language, at its very core, is a gift, not an exchange. It is rooted in what she calls communicative need.
This concept completely upends our conditioned worldview. We are so deep entrenched in market economics that we view almost everything, including communication, as a transaction.
Tit for tat.
I'll tell you this secret if you give me your attention, or I'll give you this information if you pay for my consultation. We treat words like currency.
We spend words.
But Vaughan argues that fundamentally, a true word is a gift given to satisfy the listener's need to orient to the world.
The easiest way to grasp this is to look at how we learn to speak in the first place. The text calls this the mothering ground of language.
Right, back to infancy.
When an infant is born, they don't sign a contract to learn English. They have nothing to trade.
Zero leverage.
The caregiver gives tones, songs, names, and soothing words unilaterally. The adult looks at a dog and says, "Look, a dog."
A pure gift.
The adult is giving the child the gift of a shared world long before the child can ever repay them in a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
We are profoundly receivers of language before we ever become transactors.
And notice the profound physical difference between words and material goods.
What do you mean?
If I have a loaf of bread and I give it to you, I no longer have the bread. My material supply is diminished.
Right. It's a zero-sum game.
That is the basis of scarcity economics. But if I give you a word, a story, a concept, or a warning, I don't lose it.
You still have the story.
I still have the story. In fact, the story multiplies. It becomes a shared relational space between us. Language is a primordial commons of absolute abundance.
Which is exactly why it is so devastating when language is damaged or manipulated. The text talks about anti-gifts.
Anti-gifts, yes.
If a true word is a gift that helps you orient to reality and opens your life capacity, an anti-gift is a poisoned word.
A poisoned gift.
Lies, propaganda, dehumanizing labels.
Mm.
They aren't just factually incorrect statements. They are poisoned gifts that intentionally damage the listener's ability to perceive reality accurately, severing their connection to others.
And perhaps the most pervasive and destructive anti-gift in our modern civilization is when money becomes the master language.
The ultimate reduction.
When we force the entire plural, rich grammar of life, you know, the aesthetic value of an ancient forest, the emotional value of a mother's care, the stabilizing value of community trust, and we violently compress all of it into a simple price tag, we are engaging in massive linguistic destruction.
I erase it.
We literally erase the invisible gifts of nature and caregiving because they don't have a market price.
If the only vocabulary we have for a 500-year-old redwood forest is timber revenue, we have stripped ourselves of the ability to articulate why it shouldn't be cut down.
The language fails us.
We lose the words to defend life. And the text points out that this linguistic manipulation goes all the way down to the syntax we use.
The very structure of our sentences.
The way we structure our sentences distributes responsibility and power.
Consider the phrase, pollution occurred.
The classic passive voice. It's the favorite syntax of the corporate press release. Mistakes were made. Pollution occurred. Downsizing happened.
Let's analyze what that syntax does. It hides the agent.
It makes it invisible.
It makes the harm seem like a natural, unavoidable weather event. Pollution occurred sounds like rain fell.
Nobody is to blame.
Right. But if we shift the syntax to the active voice and say, the chemical company discharged toxic waste into the municipal river, suddenly the agent is revealed.
The actor is named.
The action is named. And only when the agent is revealed can a path to actual repair open up.
So when you go to a town hall meeting or you stand up in your workplace and you say out loud, this policy is unjust and it is hurting people, you are not just making a sound.
You are doing something far more powerful.
You aren't just venting frustration. You are literally giving a gift to your community. You are providing a linguistic tool to help everyone in the room recognize a broken relationship so that collectively you can fix it.
That is the essence of civic languaging. You are bringing forth a reality that allows for life-coherent action. You are pulling the truth out of the noise.
I want to challenge everyone listening to think about the digital spaces you inhabit every single day. Look at your phone screen.
Right now.
Think about the anti-gifts you might be consuming or sharing on social media. Before you retweet that outrage-inducing headline, ask yourself, are you passing along a poisoned gift that closes life capacity and generates anxiety?
Or are you helping?
Or are you offering word gifts that help others orient, understand, and heal?
It places a profound weight of responsibility on how we speak. Every utterance matters.
So let's pull all of these threads together. This text, Bringing Forth a More Beautiful World, gives us a roadmap.
A completely new framework.
It shows us that the world isn't just a cold machine of inputs and outputs, and it isn't just a spreadsheet of GDP. It is a living, breathing web of calls and answers.
Yes.
If we want to fix our civilization, we have to learn to truly hear the calls of need, the physical and emotional absences that Terence Deacon pointed to.
We have to hear them.
We have to discern the true signal from the counterfeit noise, as Gregory Bateson taught us.
Filter the noise.
We have to measure our success not by profit margins, but by John McMurtry's metric of what expands life capacity and ensures positive peace.
Value life over false capital.
And finally, we have to coordinate all of this repair through words, given freely as gifts to build a shared world.
I think it is vital to note, as the author does by referencing the philosopher Charles Eisenstein, that this more beautiful world is not some distant utopian fantasy.
It's not a sci-fi novel.
It is not a project we have to wait 100 years to build. It exists right now. It exists in your own life, in your own community, in any microscopic moment where a genuine call is heard, truthfully named, and answered with care rather than with domination.
It's happening in every evolved nest where a parent comforts a crying child. It's happening in every true conversation where someone feels genuinely seen.
It's everywhere if you look for it.
Which leaves you, the listener, with a final question to ponder. Think about the conversations you are going to have tomorrow.
Tomorrow morning.
Whether it's with your child at the breakfast table, your coworker on a Zoom call, or a complete stranger in the grocery store line. Are the words you are about to speak merely a transaction to get what you want?
Are they a weapon?
Are they a weapon designed to make a point and humiliate someone else? Or are they a gift, a tool, to help another human being orient in a deeply confusing world?
That is the choice we have to make.
Our diagnostic landscape doesn't have to stay murky. The X-ray machine might be broken, but we have a new language now. Step out tomorrow, listen to the quiet signals, and answer the call.